Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul Venable back with us. Hey, Paul, thanks for joining us. And what we're going to do is we're going to cover the Articles of Confederation. But before we move forward, I'm not sure if you caught my Martin Luther, I Had a Dream episode yesterday. Did you catch that?
Yes, I did. I caught most of it.
Okay, great. And so, you know, I hope, because as a person that is constantly attacked in an ad hominem way, my intent was not, hopefully, it didn't come across I was trying to attack what his speech was, but you could really tell that his education is just like everybody else's. It was really lacking because he was leaning towards democracy. I mean, he thought that democracy was the elixir that is going to cure the problem, when it was actually a Republican form of government that actually cures the problem. But anyway, how did it come across?
Well, I have to be honest with you. This is the first time that I actually had heard. I heard this speech. I watched it. That was broadcast. But this is the first time since I heard it that I've heard it again.
Okay.
I actually hadn't read it. And so I'm grateful that you read it. And I think it's important. And like you said, I think there's some things that from a constitutional understanding, he didn't know.
Right.
But,
right,
you know,
right.
I have the position that he was in, the position that blacks were in the 60s was, frankly, intolerable. You know, he had this. I think he had to stand up and say something. But I agree with you that he was steeped in democracy.
Yeah.
And because he was steeped in democracy, that's the condition that Americans had been in since the mid 20th century. We actually went, there's a space somewhere where we actually went from teaching about a republic to teaching about a democracy.
Democracy, correct. And so,
okay.
So I think that was maybe one of the reasons why he included that, you know, we, you know, as we stand on this threshold of, you know, being able to become partakers of the American dream, we have to make sure that we behave, you know, properly, that we, you know, that we do good deeds and not, you know, become bitter and that type of thing. Because that is the essence of mob rule. You know, when all of a sudden the mob feels the power. And so regardless,
you know,
he actually
did the opposite of BLM.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. He was, I truly believe that he was trying, you know, as a matter of fact, I think I got into bills of attainder and bills of punishment, in talking about how there were laws that were being passed that were absolute violations of the states were violating the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, as well as the federal government. And so
you did get into that.
Yeah. And so when we had there been context, you know, to that point in time, unfortunately, Madison didn't live forever to walk around and kind of help people say, no, you can't go across that way. And as a matter of fact, even when Madison got out of office, he really stopped. I mean, there's very few times he took a stand on, you know, what was like with nullification of 1834. When he did that, that was a real rare point in time where he, you know, got into somebody else's knickers and telling them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so
sure.
it's interesting, but you have to understand that there was really no other way. You know, I've never been one to call for civil disobedience like that, but in retrospective, I think it's just there was really nothing else they could do. There was really nothing else they could do.
No. To get their attention, there was one of my dad's favorite singers. Her name was Billie Holiday.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and Billie Holiday had a song which was very controversial and made people very uncomfortable. It's called Strange Fruit.
Ah.
And the strange fruit was black men hanging from trees. Okay. Uh-huh. This was in the 20th century. Okay?
Right.
So you couldn't ignore, you could not ignore what was going on. Martin Luther King, even if he was ignorant about the Constitution, I wouldn't say completely, okay, he quoted from it, but he understood that there needed to be not just a change, but a change in the mindset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. A change in the mindset.
Yeah.
He had to do something. The black people had to do something. And, you know, I remember, you know, you see pictures of his protest. They were peaceful. They're not nonviolent. I saw them on television. You know, there's this, mm-hmm. there's one picture of this guy captured where he's being held by a police and a dog is about to bite him to bite him in the stomach. Okay. People were fire hosed.
Yep.
You know, they were just mowed down with fire hoses.
Right.
And they were willing to do that. And Martin Luther King was willing to march at the head of them.
Right.
Okay. That's got to mean something. You know, I've had people tell me Martin Luther King was a communist. I said, well, what other choice did you give him? You see what I'm saying? In other words.
Yeah, but so in all honesty, he wasn't. He wasn't because, see, a communist would have actually pursued a violent uprising. Now, when we look at Malcolm X, for a while, Malcolm X was in line because of his Islam influence. It was about compulsion and revolution for him. You know, but when Malcolm X finally started waking up and saying, you know, this is, I'm on the wrong path, that's when they killed him.
Well, Malcolm X did something interesting. He went to Mecca.
Yeah, absolutely. I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when he went to Mecca, he says, there are all kinds of people there. Okay. There are all shades of people there. Okay. Uh-huh. It was kind of an awakening for him. All right. And so what I'm, thank you for clarifying that Martin Luther King wasn't a communist, because
right.
he's been charged with that. You know, the FBI claimed, went after him and claimed he was a communist.
Yeah, yeah.
But what actually happened is his non-violent direction moved the people. It particularly moved President Kennedy.
Yeah, and so let me just say this. Something very similar happened in the 70s with South Africa and Stephen Bantu Biko. And so I tell people, and I know I've told you, to watch the movie Cry of Freedom. Because in that movie, it depicts what a threat Biko was to the establishment at the time, which is why they ended up just killing him, because they realized there's no way they could get to him. He was on the high ground, where Mandela was down, you know, down in the same, you know, valleys or the depths of, you know, the low road he was taking a communist side of the opposite side of compulsion and, you know, I'll just say, force. And so Mandela became the obvious person to swing, because as long as you have those levels of control in government, then you're in control. But if you actually give people liberty and freedom, which is what Biko was fighting for.
Right.
And so if you never saw that movie, you got to watch it, and then I want to hear your take on that, because it's a very enlightening movie. It's almost like, you know, a James Madison in 1970s in South America.
You know, I have I've got that movie queued up, and let me share something with you. It's almost like I have to build up the courage to watch it, because, you know, you've described it to me. I know it's going to be hard. okay?
Yeah.
And I have to carve out some time afterward.
Yeah.
Yep. To think about it.
So, okay. Well, maybe I should, let me know when you watch it, because it's a very powerful movie dealing with liberty, you know, and how people, you know, are being oppressed. See, in America's, you know, I'll just say in the circumstances of the founding of America and, you know, the migration this way, you know, it, some people say it was about religious persecution, but there's probably nothing more harsh than, you know, being persecuted because of how you look, something you have no control over.
Oh, absolutely correct.
Right. And so when we look at the biases of racial and or gender, just because a person is a, you know, was born a specific way, you know, and we have, you know, biases that drive people to kill and to oppress, you know, we've definitely got a problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's if you're ready to dive into the Articles of Confederation, the interesting thing is out of the Articles of Association, we're now diving into a very specific framework of government in 1877 or 1777 that they were establishing for the states to operate underneath this this limited magistrate. In other words, they weren't creating a federation. They were creating a confederation where they were giving very limited powers to this general government called Continental Congress. When they went from the Articles of Confederation to the U.S. Constitution, there was very little change. Other than the...
What do you mean?
Well, there was very little change other than giving the federal government the ability to tax and the ability to enforce, you know, having full jurisdiction by creating a judiciary and allowing that judiciary to be the judge. Because when we get into this, I think it's maybe like Article 7, we'll get into the jurisdiction of the judiciary. They never set up a permanent judiciary. This was strictly a magistrate that was a body of people, like a parliament or a, you know, like a Senate of Rome. And so, in other words, they created a model that one would have, had they even behaved properly, it would have failed.
Right. Okay.
But when they created the U.S. Constitution, they maintained a confederacy because they did not establish a federation, giving the federal government full power.
It was now, let's go ahead.
No, you
finish
go ahead.
Your sentence, and then I've got a question.
So... A federation is where the almost all power is delegated to that central governing body, a federal government, a general government, whatever. In a confederation, all the residual power that's not delegated remains, and it's very limited. In other words, in scope, in the U.S. Constitution, they only gave the federal government the power over external objects and the ability to tax. That was about it.
Okay. So what you're saying, and for, I can hear someone in the audience asking this question. Why are you using the term confederation when in the Civil War, the Confederacy was separated from what you say the Confederation is?
Well, and actually,
I'm seeing a language challenge there. Okay, so you're referring to the Constitution as a confederation, and when you put "con" in front of federation, then when we think of the Civil War era and the Confederacy, I can see misunderstanding or confusion, and I'd like to clear that up.
Okay, so what did they call? Okay, so the South went off and created a confederation. What did they call? What did they call the North? What did they call the North? They didn't call it a federation. They never called it a federation. They called it the Union.
Yeah, they called it the Union.
Because right. It was a confederation of states. It was still a union. They were both still confederations. When you look at the southern state when they or the southern states when they created their confederacy, they basically were doing a very similar model to the U.S. Constitution.
Okay.
I mean, you know, they were basically just saying we're parting on, you know, on this whole issue that we want to maintain slavery, and we see slavery as being truly threatened, and you know, you guys are coming after us for economic, you know, reasons and so forth. So we're seceding. If you can't live within the Constitution, then we are seceding.
So why is it that people are saying these days that slavery wasn't the issue, that it was tyranny that the South left?
No. Absolutely. It was slavery, because the abominable tariffs that were passed in the 1820s, mm-hmm. were targeting the South. It was harming the South, and those tariffs were unconstitutional.
Okay.
And so as they were challenged and things just got worse and worse, when it came down to the 1860 election with Lincoln, there was already these ramblings that the South was going to secede because of slavery. So when you read...
Oh, they started seceding in 1860.
Yeah. Right. Well, actually, was it 1860?
They started seceding before... Yeah, they started seceding
before the election. So when did Lincoln take office? Because they started seceding...
1861.
Okay, so they actually started seceding, I believe, in 1861. They started seceding when after Lincoln won the election in 1860.
Okay.
In other words, they saw Lincoln as, you know, and this move by the Republicans, because this was a real threat to them.
Okay.
And they just saw that they were going to be forced. This is why Lincoln offered an amendment to the Constitution that would have guaranteed their slavery. They didn't trust the North.
Wait a minute. Okay. So Lincoln, who gets credit for freeing the slaves,
uh-huh.
offered an amendment,
yes.
to guarantee slavery for the South. Why did he do that?
Well, so because he didn't want them to secede. He didn't want them to feel threatened that we were going to come after them, or that the North was going to abolish slavery.
Okay.
And
so, go ahead.
They didn't trust the North. I mean, the North never lifted these tariffs. I mean, life was getting worse and worse for them. You got to remember that it wasn't a vote by the people to choose to secede. It was if I remember correctly, there were 900 major, very affluent plantation owners in the South who congregated into a convention who basically said, we all have to secede. And so they basically went back and they started drafting up their secession letters.
Is there a documentation for that meeting? Because that would be interesting.
You know what? I'm trying to remember who reported it in a book. I don't know if it was Thomas Sowell. It might have been Tom Woods or Kevin Gutzman. But I mean, if you really look at, you know, this convention and who was there, considering how many millions of people were in the South, and these people weren't even representatives.
Okay.
In other words, they weren't, this whole process of their secession was an economic determination by those who were the influencers of the time. It's almost like Bill Gates and billionaires moving, you know, getting together and using their financial influence to say, this is what we're going to do.
Well, that's what they're doing.
I know that. History just repeats itself, right?
Right.
I mean, so have we not heard from Joe Kennedy that you get to a point when you have so much money that you no longer worry about the money, you worry about gaining more power?
See, that is just anathema to me. How do you figure that?
Well, it is, but that's the nature of, because money is power. So, you know, you hear people trying to convince, you know, people that are struggling financially to save, to save, to save, to be your own financier, to, you know, the more the more money you can save and the less you spend and the less you, you know, are driven to spend, the better off you are, because now you have buying power, because instead of spending that money, you're saving it.
Correct.
And over time, as you start earning interest, say they say, you know, a wise man earns interest, a fool pays it. And so when you look at people that have a real spending problem, they are slaves to the banks and, you know, business corporations and so forth, because they have to work. They've got to go out and work. You know, they, you know, basically allow themselves to, you know, their name and their, you know, their reputation to be sullied by, you know, not paying their debts and so forth. Now, even in today, that's not a real bad, you know, you don't pay your debt. I mean, there's not a lot of people that feel the shame of that anymore. We need to bring back debtor prison. We need to have, we can't enable these bad behaviors. But anyway, you know, there's nothing more powerful. As a matter of fact, my mother was taught this from my grandmother, my father's mom, because she took my mom under the wing, and she says there's nothing more empowering than having money and not ever having to ask for it. So saving and learning to do without. So my mom learned to how to, you know, start budgeting the house and, you know, budgeting for the house and so forth. And those types of lessons were, you know, taught to us kids. And so we start learning that, you know, how powerful you are when you don't need to go to the bank to say, I want to buy this. When you actually just buy it outright. So anyway, I mean, the only thing we've ever had to finance over the past probably 20 years is really the only thing we had to finance was a house.
Right. So, And, you know, I saw this from parents who grew up in the Depression, and they were savers.
Right.
Because they, and in fact, you know, the last two cars my mother bought, she wrote checks for them.
Yeah. So
I don't know that you can do that today.
So,
you know,
so when we look at the South was just being driven by these people that had the money, and they were buying. I mean, that's how the South got the Missouri Compromise. That's how the South was able to try to protect their way of economics. And so, by this point in time, so we have never covered this, but by this point in time, the concept of communism and slavery became entwined. And there's a guy by the name of George Fitzhugh. You can look him up. George Fitzhugh, who was a teacher in college. He was an academic professor in America. This was like in the 1830s, if I remember correctly, that was out basically telling people that all people needed to be slaves. It didn't matter what their color was. You know, people that didn't have could be taken care of better if they were, you know, if we moved to a communist state. But in George Fitzhugh's communism, the state was the plantation holders.
Oh.
Not the government. Okay. So in other words, they kind of, because at that point in time, they were the ones controlling government in the South.
Kind of like it was in an anarchy, you know,
what ended up happening. So what ended up happening is, as the plantation holders, you know, and this is where you hear the term old money and new money. The old money of the plantation holders became, you know, I'll just say were dwarfed in the new, we're going into break here. So I'll get into the dwarfing of the plantation holders by new money and how new money actually shifted America and American government. So we'll be right back after this break. So please, folks, don't go anywhere. And then we'll get into the Articles of Confederation. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so where I was going with this is as we watched, as a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton had a interesting debate, and it was not just a quick debate, it was a long-term debate in the early 1790s under the Washington administration. So it was almost a quarter century before things really, the shape of America was shifting. And what we see is that the old money of land barons, because these men, you know, were rich because of the land that they held and the revenue that they were bringing in. And Hamilton, because that's what, and as a matter of fact, Jefferson was an advocate for an agrarian society. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton said, no, an industrial society is where America needs to go. And when we actually look, we transition from, you know, what we call slave labor to free labor in manufacturing and in the industrial age. However, how free are you if you're limited? And, you know, in other words, your employer actually starts, you know, keep, you know, or that doesn't start. I mean, it's just a good business model to keep wages at as low as you possibly can because it keeps your profits up. I mean, that's just how business is. And it was no different for a, you know, whether it be agrarian and having, you know, paid laborers or slave laborers. There's still a cost of labor, you know. if you're housing them, clothing them, feeding them and everything else, there's still a cost. It is probably the lowest cost of labor possible is slavery. Right?
Right.
So as the shift started occurring in the 1800s with the advent of the railroad and the steam engine in the 1820s, the shift was really coming into America to where the northern states were becoming far more industrial or textiles and manufacturing and so forth. And so as they were abandoning this form of, you know, everybody working in an agrarian society, they were actually going to laboring in these big companies and so forth. As a matter of fact, this shift literally started coming to be, you know, as on the heels of, like I said, Jefferson and Hamilton's argument. But what ended up happening is that the old money, which was not, there was this influence, they still were controlling government, but the money that they were bringing in paled in comparison to some of these large industries or these large manufacturers and so forth. And so like DuPont mm-hmm. started really, this guy had a lot of money. And then the Rockefellers and all, you know, as they started obtaining resources, because look at how, you know, look at how DuPont and Rockefeller and some of the real big money makers, Carnegie, these folks were, they were in using raw, you know, minerals and so forth. Like DuPont was, I think, was it borax or whatever it was? I forget.
Okay.
That, you know, he made all of this money on. by, you know, manufacturing soap and so forth from these chemicals or what have you. So all of a sudden, instead of having slave laborers, he was paying people as the lowest cost he possibly could to pull minerals out of the ground and to basically make soaps, detergents, and what have you. One of the very first companies that actually was a pioneer in profit sharing, and they failed at doing this, was Procter & Gamble.
They failed?
They failed. The people, so the reason why Procter & Gamble actually started doing profit sharing was to keep the unions and organized labor from coming in and taking over.
Well, I wonder why it failed.
Because the people didn't care about the profits and being paid later. They wanted to see, you know, the money and the benefits up front. And it actually cost them, because to Procter & Gamble's, you know, demise, this insidious disease of collectivized labor that was sweeping through America in the middle 1800s, you know, became this real, it was a parasite. Everything was unionizing. But we see this whole shift where were the bigger pockets walking into the banks? The plantations were, you know, they still had a good profit, but it paled in comparison to what the industries of the manufacturing, the industrialized part of our society was doing. And there was a shift that went in that direction. And so we moved from what we thought was, you know, a slave plantation to a slave corporation.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, if you remember the when I went through, I think it was England and their Jerusalem, the song Jerusalem, where this concept of these evil mills, these production plants that were being created, which was employing a lot of people. I mean, you know, people were actually being able to start affording things because they were actually getting paid instead of just struggling as manufacturing hit England in the 1700s and 1800s. And so even though we see how people benefit, what ends up happening is these corporations start obtaining power and money and influence. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, we've seen how monopolies become very maniacal, but they become maniacal with government protection.
Correct.
And so what ended up happening, there's no doubt in my mind, the Rockefellers wanted the federal government to break up Standard Oil. There's no doubt in my mind.
But didn't they own Standard Oil?
They did. And they still owned Standard Oil after they broke it up. They couldn't. The federal government couldn't take their ownership away. All they did was they broke it up.
So there's an illusion of competition when there really isn't.
Well, yeah, what ended up happening was, see, the federal government did not have any ability to control commerce at all, corporations or anything. And so they started creating the Antitrust Act, the Sherman Act of, what is 1880, 1890, something like that. And that act basically empowered the federal government to start going after corporations where they have, that's not in the Constitution. They were violating the Constitution to do that. But they, but actually the corporations were asking them to get involved because they didn't want to have to play games going from one state to the other. So they actually got the federal government to start regulating them to keep the states from regulating them, because, you know, states could start really making it very hard as they come into your state and start establishing operations. That state could really make it hard for that corporation to be able to function across these state boundaries. Getting the federal government to actually start regulating them and regulating labor and all of these other aspects it freed up these corporations to be able to do things that, you know, they couldn't do before. And secondly, it actually kept competition out.
Right.
Because these large corporations got the federal government to create these, it's just like the ADA. The ADA in the 1990s was regulations that the large corporations basically wanted the federal government to impose so they could shut down small businesses.
And they have. So they did. So they could afford to do that. And it was another extra cost for small businesses that they had to pass on to their customers.
Yeah, just like the lawsuit against tobacco in the 1990s as well. There was so much competition in the tobacco industry that these large tobacco manufacturers who had deep pockets that could pay the little tax that they were going to be hit with for this healthcare cost. And what it did was it decimated and it brought their profits back up. Corporations have been using their influence and their money to buy and control. And this is where, we have this idea that, they've made this determination that a corporation is a person. No. We do not have a corporate form of government. But actually,
we are acting as if we have a corporate form of government, but in actuality, there's no authority to do that.
Correct, because in the 1871, the Organic Act gave the federal government the ability to start creating corporations unconstitutionally. Uh-huh. In other words, when I say gave them this authority, it was an unconstitutional authority. They couldn't do it. The only way they could have done that is getting the states to amend the Constitution. So this is why from 1871 on, every state constitution and every state joining the union, they were already putting into the state constitutions of setting up corporations as municipalities. And so even the government world was shifting towards corporations.
Okay.
And so... This was the beginning of this huge, unconstitutional shift.
Right.
In the 1870s. So that by the time we got into the 1900s, where the federal government became the obstructionists. They became the thugs for corporations.
Right. So let me, we really need...
To get into the
spend a little more time with this subject, but before we get away from it, let me ask you a question. That here we have the South, we have the beginnings of the Civil War, and it's gone up. It's been brewing for decades, and what it sounds like you're saying is that the North was so adamantly opposed to slavery that they kept poking the South in the eye.
So
they just couldn't leave it alone.
So the North, the people of the North were adamantly against slavery. In other words, the little people, the corporations, they didn't want to admit that they were employing people basically, at dangerous costs, dangerous conditions, and basically treating them like slaves because they had no protection or anything like that, right? And so the unions,
right.
that actually became this incestuous relationship between corporations and unions. Oh, well, corporations are evil and unions are good. Well, no, they're both evil. Anyway, so... As the people wanted to basically abolish slavery, the grassroots activists created the, what was the Underground Railroad. And there was these movements that were being done. That wasn't being done really by, the industries. There may have been an outlier of, people that were compassionate, that were businessmen or what have you, that made these things possible. But that was not the paradigm of the, the boardrooms of corporations in the North. It was really just, it was dividing and conquering. So once slavery was abolished and once the Civil War was done, all of a sudden, the corporations started trying to protect themselves. Actually, I don't even want to say they protect themselves. I think that they said, we still need to maintain some division. So now instead of it being over labor of slavery, now we're just going to shift over to making racism, the big issue. I mean, I can't understand how this nation got, allowed Jim Crow laws and those types of things to just move forward. As a matter of fact, here's one interesting thing. You know, over time, as, you know, the economy started really getting good, this was in the 1920s, that the unemployment of blacks became very equal. And so what I mean by this is the employment ratio, labor, salaries and everything else, there came a very close point in the 1920s to where black families were enjoying the same lifestyle as white families.
Okay.
And Lyndon B. Johnson pointed this out in a speech in the 1960s that since that point in time, you know, the blacks have been impoverished. What ended up happening was, you know, during the crash, the first people that received government subsidies from the crash of the stock market were the blacks. You know, they were getting this free housing. These were the projects that began. And so basically this was another part of the plan of dividing and conquering by creating entitlements, okay, if that makes sense. And so when we really look at moving forward as a nation, the government at this point in time literally started creating an entitlement state for blacks to basically start dividing and conquering us right from the 1920s on. This is when Margaret Sanger and the abortion clinics started being put up in black neighborhoods. This is when, you know, this social engineering really began to start moving us back into being divided, because in the 20s, even though we had prohibition and all of that, and this is when there was all of these things happening and everybody was just trying to survive and just enjoy life. And then all of a sudden the depression hit us and everybody suffered.
Right.
And so it's, and to think all of this stuff was being basically driven by the globalists at that point in time. Look at how many people died. They died in both Russia and China, as well as, you know, around the world, even in America, from starvation and doing without and plague or disease. It wasn't a good time. Mm-hmm. And this is when government was seizing control. We're seeing it today. Government is now seizing more control. We're seeing more and more people dying. So anyway, let's go ahead and dive into the Articles of Confederation. And okay. I understand you have, you know, a battery problem. And
I think I fixed it.
Okay.
So I put everything over on my tablet, and that's not going to be a problem. So
okay.
I have.
All right. So if you want to, now just go ahead. Again, this is in 1877. They had all of these delegates that came together from all of the states and basically formed the Articles of Confederation so that this new union could be formed with very limited powers. So let's dive into what this is. And there's a preamble to this, so let's start with the preamble.
Okay, so the Articles of Confederation. Uh-huh. To all to whom these presents shall come, we the undersigned delegates of the states affixed to our names send greeting. Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union between the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. 1. The style of this confederacy shall be the United States of America. 2. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence. Every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. 3. The said states hereby severally enter into a firm league of friendship with each other for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them or any of them on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or any other pretense whatever. 4. The the better to secure and perpetuate mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states of this union, the free inhabitants of each of these states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens in the several states, and the people of each state shall have free ingress and regress to and from any other state, and shall enjoy therein all the privileges of trade and commerce, subject to the same duties, impositions, and restrictions as the inhabitants thereof, respectively, provided that such restrictions shall not extend so far as to prevent the removal of property imported into any state to any other state of which the owner is an inhabitant, provided also that no imposition, duties, or restrictions shall be laid by any state on the property of the United States or either of them. Can we stop there a minute?
Yeah, go ahead. So,
yeah, I got a question.
This is kind of like the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's right in here, it says, provide such restrictions shall not extend so far as to prevent the removal of property imported into any state to any other state.
Right.
Okay. I'm hearing slavery here, but maybe I'm not.
So, no, I think you're right. I think that they're talking about being able to come and claim property that's in one state back to another state. That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But, so in other words,
you're right. The word slave is not mentioned in these articles.
No, slaves were considered property.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
If any person guilty of or charged with treason, felony, or other high misdemeanor in any state shall flee from justice and be found in any of the United States, he shall, upon demand of the governor or executive power of the state from which he fled, be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of his offense.
Right. And so this is basically what we're looking at right here is Article 4. And what article is this again?
Let's see. It's just, well,
It's the fourth article that you have one, it's two. That's those are the articles. It's interesting that they actually maintained Article 4 of the Articles of Confederation in the U.S. Constitution, because they're just breaking these things into separate sections, because this is really Article 4, Section 2, I believe, when you see the felonies, and it's just shorter language, more succinct in the U.S. Constitution. But go ahead.
Right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Full faith and credit shall be given in each of these states to the records, acts, and judicial proceedings of the courts and magistrates of every other state. They're using the term magistrates here.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So something changed with the Constitution. Article 5.
Uh-huh.
For the most convenient management of the general interests of the United States, delegates shall be annually appointed in such a manner as the legislatures of each state shall direct, to meet in Congress on the first Monday in November in every year, with a power reserved to each state to recall its delegates or any of them at any time within the year and to send others in their stead for the remainder of the year. I like that one.
Uh-huh. Yep.
No state shall be represented in Congress by less than two, no more than seven members, and no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years. Nor shall any person being a delegate be capable of holding any office under the United States for which he or another for his benefit receives any salary, fees, or emolument of any kind.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Okay. Does that mean they're not paying them, or does that mean they can't receive money for doing anything else?
They can't receive money from anything else. In other words, from any other form of government. They can't be a state employee as well as a Continental Congress delegate or judge or what have you. In other words, they really frowned upon people getting rich off of the government working at local, state, and federal level. They wanted to make sure that you couldn't dip your fingers into all of these pots, right?
Right. Each state shall maintain its own delegates in a meeting of the states, and while they act as members of the committees of the states. What does this one mean? Each state shall maintain its own delegates in a meeting of the states. So it sends delegates to the Continental Congress. And I believe this is a
I believe this is referencing the state legislatures. When they talk about delegates, the delegate to Continental Congress, those are
Okay. Yeah, they need to have their own. Okay. Each state shall maintain its own delegates in a meeting of the several states, I think is what they mean, while they act as members of the committee of the states.
Okay.
I think that needs some clarity. In determining questions of the United States in Congress assembled, each state shall have one vote. Freedom of speech and debate in Congress shall not be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of Congress, and the members of Congress shall be protected in their persons from arrests or imprisonments during the time of their going to and from an attendance on Congress, except for treason, felony, or breach of the peace. That means as they are traveling to and from Congress, they are not to be molested in their travels to meet.
Yes, right? And as a matter of fact, even while they're serving, you know, so in other words, when they're to be in session, you know, they travel to session, they're in session, and they travel from session, they are above the law unless they've committed a felony. So a felony, treason, those types of things, you know, that's not on the table, because this is the same in the Constitution. If you actually look in Article 1, both senators and, you know, the representatives, they're above the law as well. They have the same protection.
While they're in session. So I had this experience in which we were in Idaho, and an Idaho legislator, okay, was hurrying. I mean, he was speeding to get to the Capitol for a vote.
Yep.
And he got stopped, and the officer had to let him go.
Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
And so, okay. Let's see. Here we go. No state without the consent of the United States in Congress assembled shall send any embassy to, or receive any embassy from, or enter into any conference, agreement, alliance, or treaty with a king, prince, or state, nor shall any person holding any office or trust under the United States or any of them, except any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever for any king, prince, or sovereign state,
right,
or foreign state, nor shall the United States in Congress assembled or any of them grant any title of nobility. I need to mention something here.
Yeah, so this is another part of Article 4. Go ahead.
Okay, but let me share something. So we have, believe it or not, and in every state I have lived in, you know, these states have kind of agreements with sister nations or sister cities in other countries. You know that?
Yep.
I mean, it sounds to me like they're not supposed to be doing that. You know, like this is.
That's the compact clause in Article 1, right. Section 10. The states cannot go into any agreement, alliance, or anything like that. Correct.
Right. Okay, and that I would imagine that all these UN conferences or agreements that municipalities are making are obviously, you know, we're not under the Articles of Confederation.
All right, so unfortunately, Paul, we'll have to pick up your comments when we come back tomorrow. We'll have Paul back tomorrow, and we'll go back into, you know, this compact clause and this constraint that the Constitution, even the Articles of Confederation, had, where states can't enter into those types of agreements. But with that, we'll be back tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.